Well then, what are we waiting for?
Mr. President, only two lessons remain.
And I intend to finish this before Christmas morning.
Meet Thomas Richards. Good strong name, good strong job. Thomas here is an accountant for the Roxxon Oil Corporation.
And I'm sure he's a really good guy. I'm gonna shoot him in the head. Live on your television in 30 seconds.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's assistant editor, Adam Chitwood, and with me today are associate editor Dave Trumbore.
Hello.
And managing editor Brendan Bettinger.
Hello.
As you can tell, Matt is not with us. He had jaw surgery, and due to an inability to find the extremis virus, he is healing the old-fashioned way and cannot speak correctly. Today we'll be talking about all things Iron Man 3. I will tell you now that we are getting heavily into spoilers, so if for some reason you haven't seen Iron Man 3, and judging by the box office you probably have, stop now and come back after you've seen it. Specifically, we are going to be talking about fidelity to source material in films, and whether there's such a thing as too radical a change. If you've seen the film, you know that there is a major twist that somehow Marvel was able to keep under wraps regarding villain the Mandarin. Just a little background, the Mandarin is the most widely known villain of the Iron Man comics. They were originally going to use him in the first Iron Man movie, but 10 weeks before production decided it wasn't working. He was, Jeff Bridges' Obadiah was supposed to be kind of his conspirator or henchman at the end. They thought about using him for the second movie and decided not to. And they finally used him in the third movie in a way that was not expected, particularly. We come to find out that the Mandarin, played by Ben Kingsley, is actually an actor and is a front for the real villain, Aldrich Killian, played by Guy Pearce, who I'm still amazed that all of this was able to stay under wraps for this time. I mean, throughout the months of writing up stories about the film, I was in my head was thinking, supporting character Guy Pearce as Aldrich Killian, who might be there a little bit. But right now I'd like to begin the podcast by kind of opening up to you guys and talk about, is there such a thing as too radical a change when it comes to adapting source material? I know there are plenty of comics fans who are kind of up in arms about this, but I've also talked to an equal number who really enjoyed it. So what do you guys think?
Yeah, I'll have to say, first of all, that I was pleasantly surprised by this turn of events, too. It was a minor miracle that they were able to keep this quiet. You know, there wasn't even a rumor that this could possibly happen, which in our line of work is fantastic. I think it's really refreshing to come across a movie that is so hyped up, is so just prevalent. I mean, for you guys probably don't even understand that for months and months and months before this, literally anything that comes across our desk that says Iron Man 3, we post it because people are interested in it. People want to know as much as they can about it. And this was never even caught a whiff of it, which is great. As far as being beholden to a source material, I think movies are a great example of places where individual creative types, filmmakers, an actor's choice, it's a place where you can make your own decisions and put your own spin on a character or on a franchise or on a property that you make it your own. And this is a great example of two distinct filmmakers in Shane Black and Robert Downey Jr. that have done that with the Tony Stark and Iron Man character. But now it's also an example where they've done this with the Mandarin too. I personally didn't have any issues with it. I thought it was a clever turn, and I really like the way that they did it. I'm not, super into the Iron Man comics to begin with, so maybe I don't have that passion and feel any sort of betrayal by a different take on the character. But I think that movies are a place where this is perfectly acceptable and allowable. I also understand that there are people that feel differently. Brendan, what was your take on it?
I would say that in general, I'm not a believer in the, you have to stay exactly true to the letter of the source material.
If I really like a book, I would rather that the movie be
a different experience. Right. And I do think this twist worked really well as like a standalone twist. Again, we didn't see it coming. That's really cool in this kind of superhero blockbuster. We know every detail environment through set photos and marketing beforehand. So I think it's really cool that they were kind of able to trick us in this way. And it worked as a narrative twist in the story for what they were trying to say within the movie. But I do think it will be interesting how they try to incorporate that in the overall Marvel series, because it's not just one movie. This is one essentially one big story that they're telling over about a dozen movies at some point coming up. It's worth billions of dollars, and it's just a very interesting brand identity choice, I think, for Marvel to say Iron Man's biggest villain, like the most important villain in Iron Man's history, is kind of silly. Like we don't really know what to do with him, so we're just going to make him a joke.
They literally could have made him, because they connected him throughout the three films to the Ten Rings. And for fans that know the Mandarin, he has these 10 sort of mystical, magical rings. And that's what gives him his powers in the comics, and that's what makes him sort of an unwieldy character for a more realistic adaptation. And they hinted at that. So, like Adam said earlier in the intro, you know, there were plans to sort of incorporate the Mandarin from the beginning. They just couldn't really figure out a way to do it. I think, honestly, this is probably one of the best ways to do it. There are certainly fans out there that'll disagree, but if I were to see a Mandarin that was on, you know, up against Tony Stark, but wielding magic, I guess it could have worked now because we've had Thor introduced to the universe, and we've had, you know, mystical elements and alien elements and magic and all sorts of things. It could have worked, but I really like the way that they decided to go with this instead. And it's to Brennan's point, they sort of separated themselves as an Iron Man movie first in the way that they wanted to do it, and then, you know, make sure that they had continuity throughout the rest of the Marvel films, because it really felt like it had its own stamp as not just, you know, like a Lego piece in Marvel's phases, you know, three phases of films, but it was an Iron Man film first, and that's what they wanted to make sure they got across.
Well, and I think the key to what happened is it wasn't a twist for a twist's sake. It didn't feel like they were just like, well, we don't know how the hell to do it. We'll just kind of, you know, fake it. It says something about, you know, like the world we live in and you know, the state of terrorism, and it mm-hmm. provides a kind of foil for, you know, Tony Stark, who at the end of the first film said, I am Iron Man. He put a face to who he is, where, you know, you get Aldrich Killian talking about how, you know, in this day and age, the second you put a face on, you know, who you are and your acts of terror, then, you know, your days are numbered, you're stamped. And so I thought it was a really interesting kind of a story point that speaks to larger issues. And I applaud Shane Black for that. I was listening to a podcast on Empire that Shane Black and co-writer Drew Pierce were on, and because I was wondering if this idea came down from Marvel mm-hmm. or if it came through Shane Black, and he said that it was he and Drew who came up with the idea, and they went into the room to pitch it, and they, you know, were kind of assuming that they were going to get shot down. They were kind of scared to as they should be. They were a little scared to, you know, suggest this, and so they had like a backup plan installed, and they, you know, they pitched their take to Feige, and they said, Feige took a moment and he said, that could be cool. And then he said, let's work on it and let's write it up. So, and I think that, you know, it also speaks to Marvel that, you know, I mean, look, the Avengers and Iron Man 3 now stand as the two highest grossing opening weekends of all time. Mm-hmm. And it feels like we're at the height of, you know, comic book movies and superhero popularity. You see, like, it's no longer like the nerdy thing to wear a Spider-Man shirt to right. like school or something. And so Marvel has always been kind of forward thinking, and I wonder what this means for, you know, the series going forward, that they said, you know, it feels like they're kind of changing up the formula. Because if you look at kind of other comic book properties, they start with the, you know, the big villains. We got, like, we've seen Lex Luthor, we've seen the Joker. It's kind of like, where do you go from here? Is it going to be what people are going to be expecting, or are you going to give you know, a different take on it? And I think that was really interesting to see how they just took a completely different avenue towards it.
Yeah, and to an extent, like, this was very much, for better or worse, this is very much like a Shane Black movie. It definitely felt like that. It felt less of a superhero movie to me at times, and more of almost like a spy movie, because
it was a detective story.
It was very much a detective story. Yeah, it takes a very different turn from what I expected, and I was pleasantly surprised by it. I have issues with it because of Black's style. I didn't particularly like it with this specific property. We can get into that later. But I do like the choices that they made as far as the character. It does – well, first of all, okay, since we're talking about the Mandarin, great for Ben Kingsley, because now he gets to play this over-the-top, scene-chewing villain who, you know, they call him the Master at different times, and they say, you know, keep your eyes down and don't talk to him unless you want to get shot in the face kind of thing. So he's – you know, they build up this mystique around him, not only in the marketing for the movie, but within the actual movie themselves. So they're building up sort of this massively powerful and terrifying character. And then, you know, the great reveal when Downey walks in and he's just like this creepy kind of drug-addled British guy named Trevor. And Kingsley gets to play both of those parts. And obviously it's Kingsley, so he does it really well. That's a lot of fun. I mean, that's one of those great moments in movies where if you ruin it for somebody in line, like, they're going to be pissed at you for life, because that's just one of those big spoilers that nobody saw coming, and it just makes that movie even more memorable, I think, a little more iconic. But also, I still really think that it's like you said, it was Shane Black and Drew Pierce's decision, and I think that definitely puts their mark on this movie, separate even from Marvel. What this means going forward, I think there's bigger implications from this film beyond the Mandarin and how they handled him for the rest of the Marvel films. And those are more tied to Tony Stark and Robert Downey Jr. And sort of the decisions he makes by the end of the film. I think that plays more of an impact with the rest of Marvel going forward than the Mandarin necessarily does.
So one quick clarification, and I didn't get this when I was watching the movie. Mm-hmm. But my understanding from reading about it afterwards is that, like, as part of Black and Pierce's pitch, Guy Pierce is the Mandarin.
Right.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of what I understand, you know, when, you know, towards the end of the film where he says, like, you don't get it, like, I am the Mandarin. I felt like that was sort of, like, Black and Pierce's way of kind of, like, throwing a bone to the comics fans. Like, right. I mean, I guess technically if you want to, like, consider him the Mandarin, you can, but... You know, for me, it was less about like, oh, I want to see how they do the Mandarin. It was, what is this villain going to bring to this particular story, and what are they going to do with the villain? And that's where I enjoyed the film the most.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of my question, is that when you're adapting things from source material, is there a line that can be crossed? Like, is there such thing as too far? Like, where does it get blurred, or do you guys feel like it's kind of free range for filmmakers to go wild with it? How much of the original do you think, like, and this applies to, I guess, even books or mm-hmm. anything else, how much do you guys feel like that there just needs to be like the tiniest nugget of recognition and then a whole story, or do there need to be kind of touchstones?
Yeah, I feel like you can kind of do whatever you want to do with it. Unfortunately, sometimes you end up with, you know, you get Heath Ledger's The Joker, and then sometimes you get Arnold Schwarzenegger's Mr. Freeze. So it really depends on the filmmaker and the actor behind the performance. It can go either way. Sometimes it pays off and sometimes it doesn't. Brendan, you were going to jump in there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I personally, again, I like to see I'd like to see them go as far as they want to go if they have the creative motivation to do so. But I do think there's something to be said for respecting the fan base. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not really part of the Iron Man fan base. I haven't read any of the comics, so I have no love or hatred for the Mandarin character. But I feel like if, you know, the Mandarin was my favorite villain, maybe I went to the opening night dressed as the Mandarin, mm-hmm. and they said, the Mandarin is silly. Like, we can't incorporate this into the Iron Man universe in any entertaining or worthwhile way. So we are just going to throw it out there as a joke. I would feel a little foolish. I'm not saying that's wrong. I think the studio, the writers have a right to try that. But I would understand. I can understand where a fan would be really upset by this.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see, like, the writers, like, I don't know if it was Stan Lee who came up with the Mandarin, or who, you know, spent their career writing him or drawing him or coming up with all the different machinations of this supervillain. Like, I would like to see their response to it. Like, is that something that they were like, oh, that's an interesting take. I'd never really thought of that before, using him as sort of this puppet character that doesn't really exist. Or would they just be incredibly pissed because you just pretty much shat on your entire career? Like, I don't know which way they would go with it. I don't have that kind of that kind of animosity as a fan for that character. The other interesting thing I thought with how they handled the Mandarin was, obviously they have a huge, huge financial opportunity in the Chinese market. How do you handle that without pissing off, you know, literally a billion Chinese moviegoers? And I haven't seen exactly what they did.
Hey, if I can jump in.
Go ahead.
They called the character Man, M-A-N, Darren, D-A-R-E-N.
They did not. They did. Get out of here.
According to the Colbert Report.
Get out of here. Man, oh, I don't Darren. Know if I don't know if I trust the Colbert Report.
You can look it up, man.
Man, Darren.
Well, and that, I feel like that's part of the reason why it took so long to get the Mandarin on screen, because in the comic books, it's a racial stereotype. He's got, you know, the Fu Manchu, and it's a really tough character to like bring on screen. I know Favreau was really kind of apprehensive about it, even though right. they had talked about it and they were excited about it. It's how do you do this without being offensive? And I felt like the Ben Kingsley way, like, of kind of throwing together just a hodgepodge of different terrorist influences mm-hmm. felt strange, but then it made perfect sense when you saw that it was basically a facade for, you know, everything else. But
yeah, and they slapped some like Chinese tattoos on Guy Pearce at the end, which I was still kind of like, okay, we'll go with that.
Yeah. But I'm also interested in what this means for, you know, the Marvel Universe going forward. As I said, it feels like the comic book genre is at its height of it, the height of its popularity. And how do you go from here? I feel like we saw with the earlier Marvel movies that the studio is taking a kind of a more colorful approach to comic book movies than has happened in the past. Christopher Nolan kind of set the benchmark for mm-hmm. Batman Begins, and, you know, We talked about this, I guess a few months ago about comic movies in general, and it felt like they didn't really stick or kind of get together until Batman Begins. It felt like there was a formula that you could follow for success. Mm-hmm. And now with Marvel, they've kind of started a different formula, like, oh, you can take this other colorful take, whereas Warner Brothers still seems intent on going the dark and gritty route. But – you know, Marvel is what, 5 films in now? How do they keep things fresh? What do you guys think Iron Man 3 as a whole means for, I guess, phase 2 and the studio going forward? What do you think we can glean from the film to kind of get a sense of what their take on this stuff might be going forward?
I think it's great as far as the individual filmmakers and actors go, because it seems like it gives them sort of a creative freedom going forward. I mean, you've got some wacky movies coming up. A lot of them are sequels, but then you've got Guardians of the Galaxy, which is still like the biggest wild card coming up. But I think the way they keep it fresh is I don't know how much freedom they actually allow them within the room, but it seems like they're letting the directors that they pick and the actors that they hire, it seems like they're giving them a little bit more of a leash to have a more free range of interpretation for how they adapt this material. Now, with the sequel, some of it's already kind of been laid down, so there's probably not too much you can drastically do different. But especially for something like Guardians of the Galaxy, like with Iron Man 3 now and the success of it, it seems like they have a little more leeway to get a little zanier, a little wackier.
Brendan, how about you?
Well, so I would say that beyond not really knowing what to do with the comics version of the Mandarin, I also felt like they weren't really sure how to fit the events of the Avengers mm-hmm. into the Iron Man universe. Like, whenever it comes up, Tony just has an anxiety attack, and that's the resolution to that. And yeah. I mean, I don't think they really deal with that. So again, I really liked Iron Man 3 as a standalone movie, but as if you want to think of it as a sequel to the Avengers, I don't think it followed up especially well on what happened to Tony in the Avengers.
Yeah, I think it's very much like an avoidance of that. Like they mention it, but he literally avoids it anytime he's asked about it, and then the script and the movie as a whole just kind of sidesteps it. And they focus in very much on They focus very much in on Tony himself, and they don't worry about, like, the bigger picture kind of thing. They mention it, you know. Killian mentions the guy with the hammer that falls out of the sky kind of thing. So they touch on it. But, yeah, like you said, it's not a direct sequel, really. It's more of a – it's almost a side journey from that.
Yeah, the one question that everyone seems to have after Iron Man 3 is, you know, where the fuck is S.H.I.E.L.D.? Like, he's stuck out in the middle of Tennessee. He can't get anywhere. He doesn't have his suits. Like, why aren't you calling S.H.I.E.L.D.? And I feel like Marvel, like, they, in building up to the Avengers, it was really exciting, and they knew what they were doing. But then they were faced with the problem of, well, how do we do these standalone films? And it feels like with Iron Man 3, they said, you know, like, oh, we're going to make a statement that we can do these standalone films still. But they didn't really provide an answer as to how they can do that. They just kind of ignored it, which I saw an interview with Feige and Shane Black, and someone, I think it was Drew at HitFlix, asked them where S.H.I.E.L.D. is. And Feige said, you know, you'll see in Captain America 2 that they've been very busy. But that still doesn't explain how, like, you shouldn't have to have seen Captain America 2 to understand why this is different in Iron Man 3, because that's a year away, two films away.
So, yeah, I guess – go ahead.
Sorry, Sam Jackson can't appear in Iron Man 3 because that takes up one of the movies in his nine-picture deal, and they want to save it. But so I assume in the comics, like, S.H.I.E.L.D., once Iron Man meets the Avengers, S.H.I.E.L.D. has a much more active presence, like, in the standalone Iron Man series, and you can occasionally see Tony Stark calling up Thor, Captain America, or whoever he needs for their own adventures, or is that... Or in the comics, is it really like standalone Iron Man is standalone Iron Man?
From what I've heard, it's kind of a mixture of both. It's like once S.H.I.E.L.D. was brought in, yes, they did have the S.H.I.E.L.D. and the crossover issues and things like that, but they still had their own sort of standalone issue arcs that they ran too. So I forget which, my God, it was some comic artist or writer, but they were like, look, you can have those stories. We've done this for like decades now that we've had S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Avengers together. And at the same time, like, literally next to each other on the book stands, you can have an Avengers issue, whatever, next to Iron Man issue, standalone, next to Captain America, standalone issue. So I think they're taking the same approach in the movies. And I think Iron Man 3, I think it did a decent balance of having an Iron Man-centric story and having a nod to the other movies that was still sort of like, we still know that we're here and we know that we're part of this big thing, but we're just going to focus on this guy right now. I was okay with that.
Yeah, so like maybe all my fretting is over nothing, because if they have been, maybe Marvel knows how to do this. They've done this standalone Avengers balance for years, and I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, I think it's a valid, maybe not concern, but valid just idea to bring up, is how to balance all these things together. Whedon even said recently, he says, you know, I'm still working on Avengers 2. We had to do a few, you know, changes to the script or write-arounds on the script. And he was like, Shane Black isn't exactly making that easier on me because of his fantastic treatment. And that's true. I mean, the Mandarin aside, there are some crazy things that go down in this movie that it's just like, well, holy shit, you guys know that, like, he has to come back in the next Avengers, right? Like, what are you doing? Like, where is he going to go from here? That, I think, is an interesting path to follow, too, to see what he's going to do next, even though he won't show up until 2015.
Yeah, much has been made about the fact that, you know, Robert Downey Jr.'s contract is up for renegotiation. But to me, Iron Man 3 felt very much like a period instead of kind of a question mark.
Oh, yeah.
It closed the arc of, you know, the story that began with, I mean, no pun intended, the arc with Iron Man 1, with, you know, him throwing out, like, the arc reactor. It makes me wonder, you know, Downey's pushing, like, he's 48 now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much longer can he go? And I know Feige has said that they want to take a James Bond approach to it. So I'm interested to see, you know, beyond Phase 2, what happens with these characters? Do they just start filling out with other movies? Like, is Iron Man going to take a break for? I could conceivably see no Iron Man 3, no Iron Man movie happening in Phase 3. You know, we've got Ant-Man. They've been talking about Doctor Strange getting that going.
Right.
Do they kind of restart the story again in, you know, five, six years? Or, I mean, given the box office, or do you guys think that they're going to back up a Brinks truck to Downey's house and get Iron Man 4 prepped?
Dude,
for
release? They already gave him a $50 million payday for Avengers, so...
That was their bet, because he worked hard to get the role in the first Iron Man. When he signed his contract, he got the, you know, if they do get to the Avengers, he gets a certain percentage, and they were like, we'll see.
So I don't know how much a Brinks truck holds, but I don't know. I mean, he's probably pretty set for a while, but if he can bank another $50 million, I wouldn't put it past him. The funny thing was you said about the James Bond reference. First of all, I like the idea of it. Second of all, it was interesting to see that tag at the end of the film where it was like, Tony Stark will return in Avengers 2. It was very much like James Bond will return. It wasn't Sean Connery will return. It wasn't Daniel Craig will return. It was Tony Stark, you know? So they're going to keep that character. Who's going to play him is, yeah, it's up for debate. He'll obviously, I'm pretty sure he'll be back for Avengers 2. I don't know if he's contractually obligated to.
Yeah, no. It was my understanding that he was on for 6 films, which would count Avengers 2, which counts as cameo in Incredible Hulk. But I feel like he's guaranteed to come back in Avengers 2. But do you guys think that Marvel needs more Iron Man movies in the future? Would you like – I mean, we already know Avengers 2 is going to see new characters, and they're probably going to get their own films coming up. What do you guys think is the most interesting path for Marvel? Do you think they're ballsy enough to drop Iron Man for a few years or –
If I were Marvel, that prospect would terrify me. Because not only was Iron Man the first like independent Marvel movie, Iron Man's the only one that's like a huge, massive hit. I think Iron Man and Iron Man 2 both grossed over $300 million domestic, and this one's going to gross $500 million domestic. Mm-hmm. I don't think Thor, either of the Hulk movies or Captain America hit $200 million. I think they're all around like 180, 150. Mm-hmm. So I think they'll definitely keep. I don't think they're bold enough to leave Iron Man off the table for too long. The question is how much do we associate Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr.
Exactly.
I feel like, I mean, at least for me, the way he speaks the way he carries himself, like that is my only association with Iron Man really is Robert Downey Jr. So I think he has a ton of leverage in negotiating future movies if he wants to participate.
And he's very aware of that too.
Yeah.
And he could conceivably do that for, like, I mean, decades. Like, you said he's, what, approaching 50? Who cares? Like, all he really has to do is walk around, tinker in the shop, and have a drink or two, you know, throw out some snappy dialogue, and he's still Tony Stark, you know? Make a couple jokes about him, you know, trying to stuff himself in the suit because he's gaining weight or whatever. That's fine. He doesn't physically have to do anything in the suit for the most part.
No, he's, like, like, as you said, using his leverage, I know that he, like, because that suit is incredibly uncomfortable to get into. Right. I know that he has done everything in his power to not do anything anymore. So anytime you see Tony in the suit, it's got, like, the Avengers, the entire action sequence in New York, Downey never went to Cleveland to shoot those scenes. Like, he didn't know what was going on there. So anytime he's in the suit, that's not him. But, I mean, as you said, like, I mean, Liam Neeson's 60 years old, and he's in action movies every other year now, so... I mean, it's conceivable.
Yeah, and this is all about, like, RDJ's delivery and his persona and his, you know, the dialogue that he delivers. That's him. It's not, you know, for somebody like Chris Hemsworth, if he was 70 and still trying to come across as Thor, like, that's not going to work. You know, Chris Evans trying to be a 70-year-old, you know, Captain America. Again, that's not going to work. But for Iron Man, because it's a guy in a suit, I still think that's okay. But we'll see what they do with that. I don't know in the comics what they've done with Tony Stark over the years. If he's been Tony Stark from the beginning, if they've, you know, rotated in other people like James Rhodes, like Colonel Rhodes, to sort of take over. Or I don't know enough about the comics to comment on that. I'm sure our commenters will let us know. But
please,
it'd be interesting to...
I'm also very curious about that as well, because, like, one possible solution is you can keep Robert Downey Jr. around as, like, some sort of shield higher up, just kind of poking around, like, 2 days of work for every movie. Pay him enough. And because, you know, it's the Iron Man suit, you can put it on anybody. You can put it on Gwyneth Paltrow or whoever you want. Just have Downey in the background. He's still the face of Marvel for... But you can have a much more a younger actor who's kind of willing to do more for maybe less money. actually take over the Iron Man character. Yeah.
He sure. can be Batman and Iron Man.
He can be all the men.
So with the way that Iron Man 3 ends kind of Tony's arc, where do they go from here? Where do you guys – I mean, he's done the Mandarin. He's done the, you know, the Pepper Potts, like saving Pepper, and Pepper doesn't want him to get hurt. He's teamed up with Rhodey. Where do you guys think the story goes from here?
Well, let's just talk about him, you know, his character, Tony Stark, and where he ended up at the end of Iron Man 3 to begin with. Because he, you know, quite literally had everything removed from him that makes him sort of Tony Stark and Iron Man. He, after, you know, years of having this shrapnel in his heart, again, if you've made it this far and somehow managed to dodge all these spoilers, I don't know how you did it, but we're going to keep talking about spoilers. He apparently they have this new surgical technique that lets them take the shrapnel out of his heart, which he hasn't been able to do for the past like 8 years.
Extremis.
Yeah, exactly. So that's done. So no more heart shrapnel, which means they can take the electromagnet arc reactor out of his chest, which powers, you know, everything in Iron Man. So that's gone. That's in the ocean. All of his suits have been destroyed in the Clean Slate Protocol, which was just a big Fourth of July or Christmas, I guess, Christmas fireworks celebration. So that's gone. You know, what's left for him? Some people have said, you know, he still has some suits in New York. He still has his building in New York that's under renovation, so they could technically go back there for Avengers 2. But yeah, man, this, like Adam said earlier, this seems like a definitive period at the end of the sentence that is Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark. So it almost feels like unless he's just going to be a consultant for the next movie and like sort of put on that one last suit of armor for one last ride into the sunset, they're going to have to reboot that in some sort of creative way if they want to maintain any sort of consistent through line throughout these films. So that's going to be interesting to see. I honestly have no clue how they're going to do it.
Well, I'd also like to talk a little bit about Shane Black. I mean, this movie is so it might be the most director-driven Marvel film that they've made. I mean, I guess The Avengers comes close with Joss Whedon, but man, this very much feels like a Shane Black film, which is not Marvel's MO. They're, you know, you look back at the other movies and it's very much serving one purpose, and they've all got the same kind of look, like the same like cinematography, and they're all kind of supposed to fit together. But there were so many, like I was surprised at how many like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang references he got in this movie, like the ficus and everything. And looking ahead towards Marvel's Phase 2 slate, I'm wondering if they'll be more open to letting directors have a bit more freedom on that. I mean, we've only seen one trailer for Thor 2, but Alan Taylor's directing that from Game of Thrones, and it looks like an episode of Game of Thrones. There's nothing really cinematic in that trailer. And then you've got the Russo brothers directing Captain America, who come from the TV world, like TV comedy world. They've never done an action movie before. They've done plenty of episodes of Community. So do you guys think that this, like the success of Iron Man 3, would maybe let Marvel to have filmmakers have a bit more creative influence with films going forward?
Yeah, I think it will. I think it goes back to what I mentioned earlier, though, that, you know, Cap and Thor are both sequels, so they still kind of have to stay within those worlds. Thor will definitely...
Ant-Man. Yeah. I'm sorry, I completely forgot. Ant-Man, Edgar Wright. That's definitely going to
exactly.
be a filmmaker.
Exactly. I really think James Gunn's Guardians and Edgar Wright's Ant-Man are going to be probably the next two kind of just very much an Edgar Wright and very much a James Gunn film. And I think that's great for the movies. It didn't 100% work for me with Shane Black on this one, just because Black's style, I think, is very much, hey, everybody, we're in a movie and we're going to reference other movies. And to me, that just... that clashed with my kind of comic book sentiment. That wasn't, you know, it worked for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and sort of like these hard-boiled noir throwbacks, and it worked to an extent. And Last Action Hero, making fun of other, you know, action movies, to me it wasn't the right fit for an Iron Man 3. I enjoyed the film. I was taken out of it a little bit by his style. So if Marvel is going to do that going forward, then that is the risk that they take of having a very signature film, but possibly alienating some of the broader audiences. But yeah, I really do think they're going to sort of let up on the reins a little bit going forward.
I'm actually surprised they let Shane Black go this far with Iron Man 3, which is really, or Iron Man is their flagship hero. There's no question about it, I don't think. And I could see them letting the, I guess you would call them the side properties. Like, I think of Guardians and Ant-Man as, I guess until their main properties, their side properties. So I could see them getting a little bit more experimental with that. But, like you said, they got, TV directors for Thor 2 and Captain America 2. And the job of a TV director is to, make his episode, his or her episode, look like all the other episodes that preceded it. That's what I would. I mean, you have two giant corporations in Marvel and Disney running the Avengers, the $1.5 billion, or actually multi-billion-dollar Avengers franchise. Now, I would be really shocked if they just started handing it to auteurs. Although I guess that is kind of what Warner Brothers has been doing with the DC movies, with Nolan and Snyder, just handing them and their distinct visual styles a couple $100 million and just saying go.
See, I would love it if they really did it with, like, the more fringe characters. And I only mean fringe based on what is in the pipeline already, not necessarily the fan base or the comics, because I know a lot of these other characters are huge and they have huge followings. They just haven't really been done in the movies. So things like Doctor Strange, Black Panther, characters like that. You know, I'd be surprised, but pleasantly so, if they were like, look, here's a smaller budget. We're going to give these to some more of the auteurs. You guys make an interesting, you know, put your signature stamp on it, and we'll see how that blends in. I don't think they're just going to give them free reign. I think they want to be kept in the loop of how you're going to make this movie, how it's going to fit into the rest of the films, and if they think that you're able to do that. Because, yeah, like you said, Brendan, I mean, this is billions of dollars on the line. They're not just going to let anybody just go hog wild with this stuff. But it seems like with this most recent film and with Edgar Wright and James Gunn coming up, it seems like they're at least willing to take that chance. It seems like they have enough invested interest from the theater-going community now, from the audiences all around the world, that they're able to take those chances, which I think is kind of nice. They're not in the DC position where it's like, holy shit, this Man of Steel better really, pardon the pun, take off, because if we really want to start this, to build the franchise around it like Marvel's done, we need a big payday for this. It seems like they're in completely separate boats.
Yeah, it definitely feels like with Iron Man 3, it kind of feels like it's got Feige's fingerprints all over it, that he, you know, he realized that, like, the Avengers, like, they made so much money and everyone loved it, and going forward, it feels like it might have been his idea to say, all right, let's not do the expected. And I guess that comes with, I mean, if you just look at the villain reveal in Iron Man 3, it's something completely out of left field, and I feel hopeful that means that going forward, Feige knows that they need to change it up at least a bit. I mean, as you said, they're not gonna let auteurs come in and completely overhaul the franchise. But I guess the other question is longevity. Like, how long? I mean, trends don't last forever.
Right.
But there are so many properties that Marvel has and Marvel can go through. I'm interested to see if, you know, 5-10 years from now we see like cable TV, like an HBO adaptation of something that done on a small on the small screen, kind of auteur driven, when, you know, these franchises have kind of tapped out. Do you guys think that there is an end point for this, or do you feel like they could just keep going on forever, like the comic books, you know, kind of ebb and flows in and out?
Yeah, I think it can be exactly like the comics and take it across all different forms of media. I mean, you've obviously got the S.H.I.E.L.D. TV series coming out to network TV this fall, which I think is going to be huge. We'll see how that goes. And then, yeah, you've got this a lot more crossover these days of traditional movie actors coming to TV, vice versa, traditional film directors going to TV, vice versa. There's a lot of sort of this cross-pollination, not to mention the digital platforms that are coming up. So there's plenty of different arenas for these sort of side characters to see if they can get a foothold. Something that's been floated with some of these sort of the secondary characters is, you know, giving them a, like you said, Adam, like a premium channel special or like a made-for-TV movie kind of thing. You know, something like DC's Arrow. That series has done really well, but they haven't made that transition into a movie yet. And see if these characters can kind of like build up a fan base, a new fan base, something beyond the comics. and then, you know, bump them up either into a series show, either as guest stars or their own show, and then bump them up again into movie features. I really think that the opportunities are just getting started. I know it seems like we've been in this superhero kick for a really long time, but it feels like it's still kind of in the process of gaining momentum. I don't think it's burned itself out yet. And I think a big part of that is because you have these filmmakers like Shane Black, like Edgar Wright, like James Gunn, who are always going to put their own sort of spin on things, and they keep it interesting for people. It might be the same stories that have been told 1,000 times, but you have a new, fresh approach to it because you have new people that are doing it, that are putting their own spin on it.
Brendan, I know you said in your recent Iron Man by the Numbers thing that you enjoyed Iron Man 3, but it makes you wonder about going forward if WB has the better idea. What do you think about longevity for kind of Marvel's comic book plan?
Well, I guess what I was kind of speaking to there is you see the contrasting approach in Marvel. At least once Joss Whedon and Shane Black kind of got their hands on it, they're not really taking themselves seriously anymore. I think that's really clear with how they treated the Mandarin. The Mandarin is a joke. DC, at least, you know, from what we've seen of Superman so far, I guess that trailer ends on a joke, but it looks like Zack Snyder made a really serious movie that takes Superman really seriously. That takes Zod seriously.
I think he just quoted today too, that like, this is the most realistic movie I've ever made, or something like that. I saw that from him somewhere today.
Yeah. Exactly. And yeah. Batman, Christopher Nolan always seemed kind of embarrassed of the comic book origins. He really wanted to say, what if this billionaire tried to do this in the real world? What would that look like? And obviously there was some creative license, but like they took themselves seriously. And I think there is something to that approach. Like if you tell the audience, Iron Man is going to just joke about everything the whole time. Mm-hmm. Just as a viewer, it's easier to invest in dramatically in the stakes of Batman's adventures versus Iron Man's adventures. I think Iron Man is in its own way a lot more fun. Like mm-hmm. I laughed a lot more during Iron Man, but I'm guessing like a purely dramatic franchise has more longevity than a more comedic franchise. I don't know that that's a working theory that obviously we'll see how that plays out. But
I mean, yeah, because the first thing I thought of when you were talking about that was Green Lantern and how that approach did not work for them. I mean, there were a lot of issues with that movie story-wise and whatnot, but it was like you're taking a guy who's gotten the ring of power and he can make any shape out of pretty much just the color like green and green energy, but you're going to make it super, super serious. And that didn't really play for audiences, obviously. So I don't know. I don't know if their super serious take is going to be okay going forward, or if fans are just looking for like just fun comic book movies. It seems to be working really well for Marvel so far, because even Avengers is a hell of a lot of fun too. And the stakes, you know, okay, we're going to nuke the city. That's like the biggest thing that they come up with for that one. That's big, but you know, it was still kind of very comic booky and very fun.
Yeah, speaking to kind of Brendan's point, I will say that my biggest problem, or one of my big problems with Iron Man 3, was the stakes. It just felt kind of the whole president and like vice president storyline very much felt like it was just a way to get a couple more action sequences in there. Right. I felt like where the movie shined was the relationship between Tony and Pepper, and I was really looking for more of that. I felt like the stakes of it would have been better if they wanted to go small scale, which they did on Iron Man 3 in parts. They should have made it centric on, you know, the Tony Pepper relationship, and that's when you get someone like Shane Black writing that, that's when you get, you know, something special.
Yeah, I think they had to mash in, you know, they're like, we need these action beats, we need these action sequences. And to me, the action sequences kind of felt flat, except for the one where it was, you know, Tony and Pepper and then, what's her name's character, Maya Hansen. Except for that one when they were like in the home as it was being attacked. Like that, I felt a sense of dread, a sense of urgency, a sense of, holy shit, who's going to make it out of this thing alive and how? Like that was cool to me. But then like the plane sequence, which we kind of saw in the trailers and whatnot, that kind of fell flat for me.
We saw glimpses of everything in the trailers, which was one of my biggest. Yeah, I was hoping that the stuff on the ship with all of the different suits of armor was not the third act action sequence, but it was.
It totally was. Like, did you guys see the Fast and Furious 6 trailer at your screenings? Or have you seen, like, the full trailer they just released? This is a sidebar.
Yeah.
If you've seen that trailer, you've seen the movie, because they literally give you every action beat and almost matched up for the trailer, like, where it falls in the movie. And it's like there's nothing left of that movie that you need to see because it's all in the trailer. But yeah, as far as action sequences go, it was sort of formulaic. They were like, we need them here, here, and here. They need to escalate, and we want these certain elements put into it. And those kind of fell flat for me. The big thing that Avengers really took some flack for was sort of the faceless drone army, and you pretty much did the exact same thing with these sort of faceless extremists, soldiers at the end that just kind of like popped up out of the woodwork. They came out of nowhere, and there were like 50 of them. The suits were cool. The autonomous suits were cool. So I guess they needed to work that in somehow. But yeah, I'll agree with Adam that the character moments between Tony Stark and Pepper, Tony Stark and the kid, and even a little bit of Tony Stark and Rhodey, those were the strengths of the film. And definitely with Kingsley in there too. Those were the strengths. For an action comic book movie, that's kind of you don't hear that every day. You don't hear character relationships as the strength of a comic book movie.
I did feel like the action beats were well directed, but with each new blockbuster we see, each tentpole I see at the, like, I was sitting there watching the final battle sequence thinking I'm watching an animated movie right now. Like, I felt like it was very well directed. Like, I knew what was going on, and it was kind of exciting to see it fly around, but you can't forget the fact that you are watching an animated movie. Like, this isn't the raid. This isn't like a hand-to-hand combat thing. You're just watching animation.
So I do think they did a good job of taking away his powers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they had a good reason behind it, where he's tinkering with this new suit, and it can do really cool things, and it works, but he's still tinkering with it. So it malfunctions 80% of the time. Tony Stark is a genius, right? Mm-hmm. And I think they did a good job of writing him being smart, like getting out of these messes intelligently, which is that's harder than it sounds just to write a smart character.
His MacGyver moments and stuff.
That was the most thrilling action sequence. Was his handmade, you know, going assault on the compound.
His Christmas ornament bomb. That was pretty good. Yeah, that was a pretty cool little sequence. Didn't see that one coming for sure. It was interesting they chose to literally took Iron Man out of the movie for a good hour at least. Yeah, like you didn't see him at all unless he was a dysfunctioning suit getting hit by a tractor trailer or something like that. So that was an interesting idea too. They really did focus on Tony Stark rather than Iron Man. That was ballsy.
When they were releasing all those individual images of the armor, I was like, oh, this is going to be just a crazy amount of armor. I don't know how they're going to fit this all in. And how they fit it all in was, right, the first 80% of the movie, he gets like a hand at a time. And then, for five minutes, all the armor comes flying in, and then they blow it up. But it was cool to kind of see for each individual armor to get its moments.
I'll ask you this, though. Did you buy, like, as much as I enjoyed it, I was still bothered by some things. Like, I didn't buy Downey Jr.'s performance of, like, his anxiety moment. I didn't buy it. Because he's basically like, anytime somebody asks about the events that happened in New York, he's kind of like, I am now having an anxiety attack. And I just didn't buy it. Like, I like his dialogue. I like his delivery and his wit and his kind of, like, offhand remarks. But his actual acting in this one, when he was supposed to, like, break down and be an actual human who was suffering from these, you know, post-traumatic stress disorders, that I didn't really feel. They didn't do anything visually to sort of, except for one dream sequence, they didn't do anything visually to like flash back to it and show that he was like seriously like freaked out by this stuff and he couldn't physically handle it. There was nothing that happened sort of in the heat of battle that triggered an anxiety attack either. He was just like, nope, over it, it's all good. I didn't feel that, and that took me out of it a little bit. I just want to know if you guys had the same kind of reaction.
It felt strange. It very much felt like, you know, Shane Black is like averse to any sense of sentimentality. Anytime there was like a shred of like sentiment in this movie, he would be overcut by, you know, Tony Stark calling the kid a pussy or something.
Right, so exactly.
It felt like that was kind of deliberately, like he was undercutting like the serious, like the graveness or the seriousness of the panic attacks.
And I think that's where I dislike Black's kind of take. It's just like there are moments where you need to show a little bit of like the human side of things, and not just by removing the suit and making him use his brain, but if he's really suffering from these anxiety attacks, like, we need to see that. You can't just tell us that, and I don't know. That was one sticking point that I had. It didn't feel quite genuine, and that's what made me feel like the whole thing was just kind of like, we're in a movie, and that I didn't really like too much. Do we have time to talk about Pepper at all? We haven't really talked about her too much.
Sure.
That was great. I loved what they did with Pepper. I kind of liked the screwball comedy banter with her and Tony for the first two movies, but don't like had no particular affection for her character. I was a little unsure. Like, once she fell to her death, you knew that she was coming. You knew that she was going to come back up as an extremist monster. And I don't know if they should have tried to trick me more, but I was at that point. I was like, oh, I was really unsure how that was going to play out. And I think Gwyneth Paltrow did a really nice job with it. Like, she really got into the physicality of it. Like, she pulled that off for me. Which I was skeptical she could do.
Yeah, I was very much of the opinion of basically like, okay, so Killian was basically in love with her for a really long time. He wants to use her as leverage against Tony Stark. So he's going to strap her to a gurney and pump her full of experimental medicine that will A, kill her and blow her up real big, or B, turn her into a superpowered freak monster who's probably just going to kill him. That didn't really play out too well for me. I thought that was a little forced and a little strange. It was cool that she got like a hero moment, but they could have done the exact same thing with her getting like her own specially outfitted suit. You know, I talked to a comics buddy of mine. He was saying like she should have just gotten the rescue suit. I don't know what that means, but apparently there's like some special suit that Pepper wears, I guess, in the comics, or that's made for her in the comics, which they could have done. They didn't necessarily have to inject her with this bizarre treatment, turn her into a freak monster and have her save Downey at the end of the day. I was a little weirded out by that too. That didn't really jibe for me. So that one, I think we'll disagree on that one. I didn't really like the treatment. I like the idea. I liked making her not a damsel in distress, but the actual method of doing it was weird. Very strange.
Totally agreed. They could have just given her a suit. I do kind of like that they've been somewhat sparing with the suits. Like, it's not like everybody gets a suit. The kid, he gets a suit, and he's going to fly into battle.
He's like the Oprah Iron Man suits. A suit for you, and a suit for you.
Exactly. I don't know how... I was kind of wrapped up in it all to figure out how well this movie works on a plot level, but I think it laid out all the points that it wanted to get to, and it got there at a rapid enough pace with enough quips, enough fun, that it kept me into it the entire time. And I think I give it credit for that, but the way you lay it out, I may have to revisit that.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's like in the moment, it's fun, but then when you think about it, it's kind of like, well,
yeah.
Yeah, I started kind of rolling my eyes at the, like, there were so many different, like, reveals and, like, play. It was basically just plot devices that felt a little too, didn't jibe too well with kind of Shane Black's kind of tongue-in-cheek. It was a detective story. And then when it was like, oh, Rebecca Hall is really bad, and I was like, really? Obviously, like, we're in, like,
for 12 seconds.
Again. But I did like his writing of Pepper, and I don't know if her having her own suit would have worked too well, because in the previous film, she's not the biggest fan of you know, Tony and his suits. Like, she kind of tolerates it, but she doesn't love those, so it wouldn't necessarily have made sense for her to have her own suit, at least in my
mind. But I mean, even if, well, this is a nitpick, but like, even if, because he said like, I calibrated it specifically for you or some bullshit like that, like, he could have had one of them just like automatically do it. But yeah, that would have put her as a damsel in distress. Since poor Matt can't talk, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I did
read
his review.
Don't speak for
me. he brings up, we have Matt locked in the basement, if you couldn't tell. He does bring up a lot of good points about, like, there are ideas and themes that are brought up throughout this movie constantly, but they're never fully fleshed out or realized. And unfortunately, we're running short on time today, so we can't really get into them. But there's a lot of just sort of, like, half-cooked ideas here that I feel like, I don't know if they were left on the cutting room floor kind of thing, or if they were just part of Shane Black's ADHD and they never really got completely finished.
Shane Black did say that in one version of the script, Pepper sleeps with Aldrich he makes a sex tape and broadcasts it in Home Depot. And that was like something they were seriously considering, and then, and I mean, they rightly like went away with it, but they were trying to convey the fact that, like, I guess Aldrich's like pheromones from the extremists was making her like get onto him. But I thought that was interesting. And Drew Pierce had said that they got in many fights over how many times he could say the word fuck, because he legitimately didn't think Drew Pierce was telling the truth when he told him he probably couldn't say it once. He was like, no, we can have a couple, right?
I thought you can have like
PG 13. Well, it's kind of like, it's not a steadfast rule. If there's a lot of like violence, then the one's not going to fly. But
you can drop pussy as much as you want, but you can call 12-year-old kid a pussy.
I feel like that was their one that like they were. Yep. He was like, all right, we can cut everything else out, but we're keeping that. Like,
yep,
not exactly. Getting rid of that.
Dads leave all the time. Get over it, you pussy. At that point, I was just like, this is a Shane Black movie. Yeah.
All right, well, is there anything else you guys kind of want to talk about the movie, or should we move on to recommendations?
Man, I could probably talk about this quite a bit more. I've only had like a day to process it. There's a lot of, like Matt said, sort of the unfinished business of it. But
there is. It's not a perfect film, and I didn't fall head over heels for it when it ended, but there was enough of it that I liked that I kind of enjoyed. But
speaking of the ending, you want to talk about the tag real quick? Sorry to cut you off.
Sure. I mean, I thought that was kind of unexpected. I was looking for something. Well, I guess that kind of ties into what we were talking about, how this gives us an idea of Phase 2 movies moving forward. I was looking for something that would tie into, like, The Avengers 2, or, you know, there were all the rumors about, like, he's going to go into space and meet the Guardians of the Galaxy, which made no sense because they haven't cast that movie yet. But it was a character moment, which I loved.
Yeah, Brendan, did you see did you stay for the post-credits tag?
I did. It was funny.
Yeah, from people that I've talked to, they were kind of like, I expected something more to like tie it into the rest of the films. It was more like a shawarma moment than an actual like tie-in. It was just kind of like a fun little gag kind of thing. But yeah, it was okay. It was all right. So if you guys haven't seen it, again, I don't know why you're still listening to us, but stick around till the end of the post credits. And there's a nice little scene at the end. That's all.
Shall we move on to recommendations?
Sure thing.
Dave, what do you got for us?
Since I mentioned it earlier today, I'm going to go with 1993, so we're going back 20 years for you youngins. Last Action Hero. I might have mentioned this earlier in a different podcast. I really do love the film because it's completely insane, and I think it was underrated at the time, probably still is today. Some work was done by Shane Black on the screenplay. I believe it was a Zach Penn story to begin with. But basically the idea was they were going to do this sort of satire of all the action movies of the sort of the 80s and early 90s. And who better to get to play your action movie satire hero than Arnold Schwarzenegger? He basically plays this movie hero who literally exists in the movie while you're watching the movie. So it was very sort of one of those early meta moments. and it focuses on this kid named Danny Madigan, who is played by, let me get his name here, Austin O'Brien. And he plays a kid who goes to the movies, and he sort of gets like this golden ticket kind of thing, and he's drawn into the movie itself. So now he's not only in the world of one particular movie, he's, because of this ticket, he opens up the world to all movies, which means there's good guys and bad guys that can sort of come into the real world and wreak all sorts of havoc. There are some interesting not cameos, but just interesting starring moments for some other characters, like Charles Dance, who a lot of people would probably know as Tywin Lannister from Game of Thrones now. He's actually the main bad guy, who's pretty crazy. He's got a fake eye, always has like a different painting or character or something on it. He's pretty bizarre. His name's Benedict. It's actually got Ian McKellen starring as Death, which is fun. Fun for Ian McKellen to play. It's a completely crazy movie. They do all the action movie tropes that you could think of because that's exactly what the movie's about. And they call them out, too. It's very much talking, breaking the fourth wall, talking to the audience, and just saying, like, here's everything goofy that you've seen in action movies over the last 15 years, and we're going to present them to you in 2 hours and 10 minutes, 2 hours and change, for The Last Action Hero. If you're thinking, like, the director couldn't handle this because he's just like some spoof director. No, it's John McTiernan. So, I mean, it's the guy that did, you know, Die Hard, Die Hard with a Vengeance. He did Predator, you know, Hunt for Red October. The guy knows his action movies too. So I thought it was a great, great cast, a decent writing group to kind of bring together for something like this. This was very much like a Shane Black film too, in the sense that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is a Shane Black film. You can sense his presence there. You can see his sort of his input in it. If it's been a while since you've checked it out, or if you've never seen it before, definitely go back and give Last Action Hero a chance, and keep in mind Shane Black, and I think you'll be okay. You'll enjoy it.
All right. Brendan, how about you?
So I was trying to think of if there was any precedent for what they did with the Mandarin, right? Where you go into the movie assuming that he's the main villain, and then they do something completely different with him. So do you guys have an example? Does any example for you come to mind for you guys?
Well, now I'm thinking of yours, and I understand why you picked this movie.
Yeah. So I don't have a great example, but the closest thing I came up with was Terminator 2. Because at least the IMDb trivia says that I was 3 when this movie came out, so I don't really know. But that they were supposed the idea was to not show any footage of Arnold and the kid in the promotional material, so that you would go into the movie thinking Arnold is still the villain that's chasing them, and it turns out that in a big reveal that he's actually he's a new model programmed to save John Connor. So not a perfect example, but I also think it kind of fits with the way Iron Man kind of had to interact with. I forget the character's name, but I really liked that kid, Ty Simpkins. I'm always terrified of precocious kids, but I think he did a good job. So there's that theme kind of playing through, with your hero who's not really a good father figure, but he's kind of forced into it and finds some chemistry. Sorry if you guys are trying to recommend like underrated or underseen movies with this. Terminator 2, I think a few people have seen. I won't describe the plot in much more detail. But if you haven't seen it, you should probably see it. It's pretty good.
No, it fits.
That's a good call. I didn't even think of it that way.
If I could ask a favor, when you post the trailer under my recommendation, post the teaser trailer.
Will do.
Thanks, Matt.
As opposed to the trailer where they show Arnold's the good guy, the teaser trailer is pretty cool.
I am recommending, it's kind of obvious, but I feel like it has so much in common with Iron Man 3 that I have to recognize Shane Black's only other directorial feature, which is 2005's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. If you haven't seen it, stop, run to the video store, get on Netflix, and see it, because it is incredible. It's a Shane Black film through and through, but as told completely through his lens, so everything kind of makes sense, as opposed to that kind of compromise with, you know, a blockbuster carrying on a different character with Iron Man 3. It's a crime comedy. It also stars Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer. It has all the hallmarks of a Shane Black movie. It takes place at Christmas. It has the voiceovers. It's kind of a noir, hard-boiled, kind of novelistic story, but told in kind of a tongue-in-cheek fashion. Robert Downey Jr. plays Harry Lockhart, who at the beginning of the film we see on the run after a botched robbery, stumbles into a test session for it's some people are casting either a movie or a TV show, and he kind of swept up in kind of his partner gets killed. He gives what they think is an incredible performance, but he's just kind of acting, you know, acting in correlation to the events that just transpired. And so he gets brought out to LA, where he is paired up with Val Kilmer's character named Gay Perry. Perry is a private detective who works for Hollywood as kind of a consultant on their films to make sure that, you know, they're doing all the law enforcement pieces correct. And while Robert Downey Jr.'s character is accompanying Gay Perry on a stakeout, they stumble upon a dead body that's being dumped, and it sets into motion a series of events that play out in incredibly entertaining and funny fashion, and also exciting. You know, at the end of the film, you can see kind of how well Shane Black stages action sequences with a lot of great character beats within them. And so if you haven't seen it, I implore you to go see it. It has a lot in common with Iron Man 3. In fact, I saw someone's Twitter review of Iron Man 3 was that it was good, but it felt a lot like Shane Black yelling, "Fuck you for not seeing Kiss Kiss Bang Bang." You know, there were a few kind of in-joke references in Iron Man 3 that correlate back to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. So definitely check it out if you haven't seen it. I hope you have enjoyed listening to us discuss Iron Man 3 over the last hour. The Collision will return next week. We'll be discussing The Great Gatsby. Matt will hopefully be back. We're very happy to have Brendan on, who has been kind of the faceless presence of Collider.
thank you for having me. This was fun.
I hope to have you on again sometime soon. You can follow this podcast by following us on Twitter. I'm at Adam Chitwood. Dave, where can we find you?
You can find me at Dr. Claw MD.
And how about you, Brendan?
At Collider Brendan.
Great. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you.